listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM. Thank you, Shelton Walden. I'm Charlie Finch. Glad to have you with us, as on every Thursday afternoon. In honor of my guest, Leonard Harris, the writer, writer of novels, and writer for television, longtime WCBS-TV cultural critic, we're going to play some Cole Porter throughout the show today. And let's open with Francis Thorne, Porter on My Mind. I Happen to Like New York.
I happen to like New York. I happen to like this town. I like the city air. I like to drink of it. The more I know New York, the more I think of it. I like the sight and the sound and even the stink of it. I happen to like New York. I like to go to Battery Park and watch those liners booming in. I often ask myself, why should it be that they should come so far from across the sea? I wonder if it's because they all agree with me. They happen to like New York. One Sunday afternoon, I took a trip to Hackensack. And when I'd given Hackensack the once over, I took the next train back. I happen to like this town. I happen to love this burg. And when I'm ready to give the world my last farewell, and the undertaker starts to ring my funeral bell, I don't want to go to heaven, don't want to go to hell.
Harris, when you were the on-air cultural critic for WCBS-TV here in New York, you set a standard of sophistication and urbanity that I don't think has been met by any on-air personality since then. As a longtime New Yorker, has it changed a lot culturally since those days?
Well, first of all, thanks for the compliment.
My pleasure.
I was quite willing to let you go on talking for the entire hour if you're going to do that. Has it changed since the 60s? Sure, and someone who's lived in New York, in addition to being a critic in New York, who's lived in New York all his life, which is getting to be a number of years, I've seen the change over a much broader perspective, a longer focus than that. And, yeah, it has not changed for the better. But I remember back in the 60s, people saying, oh, it's so much worse than it used to be. And I suppose it's going to be that way always. People will remember fondly that things were better. That's a function of getting older, but I'm sorry to say it also happens to be true, that things used to be better culturally and in most every other way in New York.
You're working on a book that you're currently writing called War Songs, which is set in New York during World War II and deals a lot with music. There's a musician at its center. Tell us a bit about that book.
Well, it is the kid, the hero of it is a New York kid. They say that all novels are autobiographical. I've written three so far, and they all contain bits of me or the me that I wish I were. And certainly this boy is from the Bronx, and I spent a lot of my life in the Bronx. He's a musician. I'm a jazz fan. He plays the trumpet, and I did a little bit and very badly. He's a very good trumpet player, but actually the action, as far as he's concerned, is set in the places he finds himself in World War II. It is also set, the novel is, in current time, and that part is set in New York. One thing I learned in writing novels is you have to write about a place that you know, and the only place I really know well is New York.
Now, this character in War Songs is a member of the 101st Airborne who dies in the war. I don't know how much you want to give away about
your
book. Well,
that's it. But, now nobody will buy it. No, it's a long way from coming out. Yeah, the unit I fastened upon is the 101st Airborne, which is a famous, the Screaming Eagles, because of their emblem, which is an eagle seen in profile with his beak open as if screaming. It was one of the two airborne divisions that parachuted behind enemy lines on D-Day, June 6, 1944, in Normandy. It was the same two divisions, namely the 82nd Airborne and the 101st Airborne, who were trucked, didn't drop, to Bastogne in the Battle of the Bulge. And those two divisions, the 82nd was trucked up to a northern point, but the 101st went to Bastogne. They were the heroes of Bastogne. They saved Bastogne from the oncoming German columns and thwarted the famous German counterattack. And it was their general, Anthony McAuliffe, who's become known as Anthony Nuts McAuliffe, he was the acting commander of the 101st. And he's the one who, when the Germans suggested he surrender, came out with a one-word answer, nuts. The way it actually happened was, one of his subordinates came to him and said, they want us to surrender. And he said, ah, nuts. And then he began thinking of what kind of reply he should frame, there being no question that the reply would be in the negative. And he said, well, I don't know quite what to say. And the other officer said, it would be hard to top that one word, General. And so the one word sent back was nuts. And when the German English-speaking officer who got the reply and looked at it said something to the effect of, may I take it that this is a negative reply? And the officer who had presented it to him, who was not McAuliffe but one of his subordinates, said, yes, now turn around and get going, Buster, meaning he had come, you know, under a white flag, get back to your lines. And of course, they held Bastogne. Patton's tank columns came up from the south, broke through the German encirclement, and that was the last major German offensive of World War II.
Do you have a VE Day celebration in New York scene in the book?
No, I don't. First of all, I'm not that far in the book. And second of all, my hero is killed before that.
And what is the connection between present time and the World War II era in terms of contrasting New York then and now, for example?
Well, I haven't really formulated. I'm working on the structure of the plot. So the contrast in New York is not there yet, and it may never be a major theme in the book. What is contrasted is the music of that era. As the title suggests, this is a book about the idealism and the music of World War II and its spirit as contrasted with the spirit and the music of the current era. So the current time is set in 1990, and it's a question of this deceased soldier's younger brother looking for the family that he now suspects his dead brother had that he never knew about.
Leonard Harris, were you a habitué of Swing Street, being a jazz fan?
No, essentially Swing Street was before my time. I was like a kid in the Bronx. First of all, I was very provincial, and my music was listening to radio, was listening to big bands on the radio. I did not go to Manhattan a lot. And when you think of cosmopolitan New Yorkers for young kids, it's mostly kids who live in Manhattan. The kids who lived in the boroughs, at least when I was a kid, were very provincial and stayed in their
hometown. I was just reading Moss Hart's biography, Act One, and he talks about having to deceive his mother in order to go see Broadway for the first time as a child. That sense that you'd never come into the city.
Yeah.
It was like being in another part of the state, essentially.
Well, the only time that we kids from the Bronx came into the city, there were two subways running to my neighborhood. One was the East Side IRT that went down Lexington. We had no reason to go to the East Side, whatever. There was nothing there that interested us. The other was the West Side IRT that took us to the only places we cared about, namely the big movie theaters in the Broadway area where you could see the big bands and a movie, the Capitol, the Paramount, the Strand, and Madison Square Garden, where you could see, well, I used to see a lot of track meets, but you'd see basketball. Those were the main things. But That was my knowledge of Manhattan. However, my parents were interested in the theater. My father was interested in the theater. And when I was relatively young, they took me to see not the original Broadway production, but one that was touring. And the City Center used to be a stop on the tour then of a show. It was Bloomer Girl, which was a wonderful musical set in the Civil War, and that was the first show I ever saw. So unlike Moss Hart, I didn't have to sneak away.
During your days as a theater critic, first of all, how did you become a theater critic?
Well, that question was asked of George Bernard Shaw, and he said, when they told me to be a theater critic, nobody had ever asked me whether I could even read or write, let alone whether I had ever read Shakespeare. Mine came about really as haphazardly as that, except that I had expressed a lot of interest in it. I was working for a now defunct newspaper called the World Telegram and Sun, which was itself the product, as the name suggested, of a combination of the New York World, the Telegram, and then in the 50s, the Sun was amalgamated into them. I went to work for them in 1960 as a rewrite man, which I was very proud of, because on an afternoon paper, rewrite is the high place that you get to, because they're breaking stories, and to be a rewrite man is to be, at least considered by them, the creme de la creme. But they asked me if I wanted to be the nightclub critic and the second string theater critic. And I knew nightclubs had all the comics that I loved, and music. Well, there were a lot of nightclubs then, and so I said yes. And they never asked me to take a test or anything. Actually, I had done a few reviews for my old newspaper then, the Hartford Courant, which is where I got my newspaper start. And so I started working as a critic. And, you know, when you say, is the culture scene different? I remember worse now than it was then, and I say yes. And I say, they were saying that then? And they were saying it then. The nightclub scene particularly. But when you look at the nightclubs that existed then, there were some really wonderful nightclubs, if you like, Flash and that kind of stuff. And everybody said, oh, it's not the way it was back in the 40s, which was quite true. And now, of course, it's not at all the way it was in the 60s when I was doing it.
Did you have one or two favorite cabarets that you'd like to hang out in?
Well, I was married and I had two young kids. So I can't say that I really would hang out in them. I would go to them for business, but I loved my work. And back then, on 79th Street, there were four clubs clustered around 79th and 2nd, all Middle European. The best known of them was the Viennese Lantern. And it really was a wonderful feeling that one got, because in the 60s, there were still many European-born refugees from the war, people who had immigrated for whatever reason. And you had that feeling of Middle European joy about those four places. And you could really, one Friday night, I went to all four of them in one night. They had their shows arranged on a Friday night so that I could go 1, 2, 3, 4, right around 79th and 2nd. The Blue Angel was another great spot in New York when I was there. That's where I first saw Woody Allen as a stand-up comic at the Blue Angel.
Did you ever have the experience of breaking a star's career where you saw a performance so fascinating as a critic that you were the first to discover that star?
Well, I don't know that I was ever the first, but I remember seeing and liking George Carlin when he was pretty much a straight-up stand-up comic at a place called The Living Room on 48th Street and 2nd Avenue. And a lot of young talent. Renee Taylor was there. And I like to think I helped them with favorable reviews. I do remember seeing a really unknown Stiller and Mara at a place down in the Village. I wish I could remember the name of it. And stopping to talk to them after the show. And I think they'll always remember that, because I did give them one of their first good reviews. Also remember Woody Allen dropping me a note thanking me for all the help I'd given him. You know, and I wasn't doing it to help him. I did it because I thought he was pretty damn good, and he was.
Was New York in the 50s and 60s, Leonard Harris, as gossip-conscious and mean-spirited with Walter Winchell, Dorothy Kilgallen, and those columnists as it is now?
Oh, it was probably more so. The gossip columns were a much bigger part of the media scene because newspapers played a much bigger part than they do now. Television has taken away a lot of the impact that newspapers have generally, and certainly that gossip columns have. Back in those days, there were, in the PR world, there were column item men or women, and they earned a living by means of a specialty, which was placing items in columns. And there were enough columns. There were two or three in the World Telegram alone, and then there were others in the Journal American. And there were others, there was never one in the New York Times, so they never had that, but there was the News and the Mirror. And the Herald Trib, I guess, had a column, too, where you could, where items could be sent. And there was enough work for several of these people just to plant items. And the usual system was you'd have to give them, if you were the PR person, something legitimate and good along with the plug for whatever restaurant you were trying, or personality you were trying to plug. So gossip columns played a bigger part then than they do now.
You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. This is Art Breaking. I'm Charlie Finch. We're talking to the writer Leonard Harris, longtime cultural critic for CBS and a writer of novels as well as scripts for television. We're listening to Francis Thorne's Porter on My Mind today for our musical selections. Let's go to Night and Day. Francis Thorne on piano, Jack Six on bass.
Like the beat, beat, beat of the tom-tom when the jungle shadows fall. Like the tick, tick, tock of the stately clock as it stands against the wall. Like the drip, drip, drip of the raindrops when a summer shower's through. Oh, a voice within me keeps repeating you, 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 night and day. You are the one, only you beneath the moon and under the sun. In the silence of my lonely room, I think of you.
Wow. Welcome back to Art Breaking. Leonard Harris, is it true that Joe Papp got you your first on-camera job for CBS?
Gee, where did you hear that? Well, not...
Little Bird told me a few seconds ago.
Not quite true. I like to think I got it myself, but back in 66, when the World Telegram was in the act of folding and merging, and there was a merger strike on, and I had two young kids, and I needed a job, and I had heard that the job of the arts critic at Channel 2, WCBS-TV, was open. And they said, well, go out with a camera crew and do some kind of story for us. And I had no idea what to do, but Joe Papp had just bought that old Astor Library down on Lafayette Street and was in the act, the very beginning act of gutting it to put in those theaters. And I called his press agent and I said, would Joe come down there and just do an interview? I want to do a story about this theater. And he said, Joe wants to know how long it would take. Well, they wanted me to do a three-minute piece. I didn't realize that a three-minute piece can take hours to do. And I said, well, three-minute piece, it'll take him, he'll be there for 5 minutes and that's it. So he showed up with George T. Delacorte, a major contributor to Joe Papp, then and afterwards, and for whom the Delacorte Theater in the Park was named. And it was a cold, blustery March day. And I started interviewing him, and of course the camera setup takes a long time, and everything takes a long time when you're with a film crew. Back then we were shooting with film and not with videotape. And at one point, after we'd been there about an hour, George T. Delacorte started sneezing and coughing and waved to Joe Papp and said, I'm leaving, and he left. And Joe stayed with me very loyally, and we did the audition piece, which was instrumental in, or one of the instrumental things in my getting the job. And a year or two later, Joe Papp said to me, I want you to know that Delacorte caught cold at that interview we did, and he has never given me a penny since that. Well, I felt obligated to Joe, not to the extent of ever fixing any reviews for him, needless to say, but George Delacorte subsequently did give Joe a lot of money, so I felt a lot better after that.
I saw Nick and Nora the other night and was just amazed at how bad it was, and something has to be really bad for me to think it's bad. It seemed that the actors really had no conviction, and the music was very samey, and the dialogue was frankly pretty tasteless. Is the Broadway musical dead?
Well, I guess Broadway is glad you're not a critic.
I kept thinking during Nick and Nora, Frank Rich, the Butcher of Broadway, is going to have a blast with this one.
Well, unless they fix it. Now, I know the composer, Charlie Strauss, and he has said to me that they've been having a really tough time in rehearsals. The rehearsal experience has been very difficult. On the other hand, I know somebody who saw it and said it was too long, but kind of liked it. So let's hope that they fix it. It's not opening until December 8th, I think it is. They just postponed it again. Let's hope they fix it. Broadway is virtually only musicals now. The expenses of putting on a Broadway show have become so exorbitant that it takes 2 years to make your money back. And the only things that seem to be able to do it are musicals. So, you know, Broadway is not in particularly good shape. It did not have a good season last season. But again, going back to nightclubs, they've been saying that about Broadway for centuries. The Fabulous Invalid. And I think and I hope Broadway will, everybody will keep saying it's getting worse all the time, but it's going to keep on going.
Do you think the British invasion of Andrew Lloyd Webber and Les Miserables and on and on and on was a bad influence on Broadway musical standards? Bad music, no plot, lots of sets, little acting?
Well, I think that any show that brings people to Broadway is a good thing for Broadway. I mean, those musicals certainly did not drive away other musicals. There's this Broadway vacuum that where those things flowed in. I personally don't like the later Andrew Lloyd Webber shows. I think there are a lot of flash, a lot of pretty melodies that sound like his other pretty melodies, which in turn sounded like Rodgers and Puccini. But I've seen a lot worse musicals than Andrew Lloyd Webber, Les Miserables being one of them in my estimation. But I wouldn't go to them, but certainly they are what's attracting people to Broadway. And you've got to say that it's better that they be there than nothing, because the choice is not between them and something else. The choice is what you can raise money for. And as a recent article in the Times said, nowadays to put money into Broadway, you've got to be rich and eccentric.
I can remember as a boy seeing No Strings, the Richard Rodgers musical, which starred Richard Riley and Diane Carroll, and Richard Rodgers taking the musicians out of the pit, putting them on stage back in the wings, and having a jazz motif. It was a wonderful, wonderful score, one of his best. Do you think there's any chance that jazz and Broadway could mingle to create a new kind of musical form?
Well, again, you got to go back and look at a little bit of history. By the way, I like No Strings a lot, too. The interesting thing about it for me is it's the only show where Richard Rodgers wrote the words as well as the music. And then the words were quite nice, and I remember the songs very well. Jazz, in its form of the late 30s and early 40s, namely swing, was the dominant popular music in America only once, only that one time. Jazz was the dominant music. That is, in the form of big bands, it was also top 40 music. It happened once, never true before that, and it's never been true since. At the same time that was happening with big bands, 30s and 40s, it was also happening with Broadway musicals, even into the early 50s. I mean, Some Enchanted Evening, show that opened in early 49, South Pacific. Perry Como's record of Some Enchanted Evening was number one on the hit parade. There's no Broadway show that produces a number one song anymore. So that was a time. And you're talking about two kinds of music, neither of which is in the mainstream of popular music anymore. They're both there and they're both wonderful. So I don't think they can combine to form a mainstream music. I think the mainstream has moved away from both of them, which is one of the crimes of American music.
But Leonard Harris, with the Marsalis brothers and Harry Connick, the new generation seems to be really nostalgic for that time and creating music that's very imitative of post-World War II jazz. Is that a good development?
Well, I think it's a wonderful development, but I question whether it will ever be more than a side current, and a wonderful side current. I mean, I like Wynton Marsalis. He's not exactly my favorite kind of jazz musician. I like Harry Connick, too. And I know Harry Connick is extremely popular. But again, they are not the mainstream. I'm delighted that they're arousing young people to the joys of jazz and big band music. I think that's great. But don't look for those two kinds of music ever to be what they once were.
Have you been a Sinatra fan, or do you not care for him?
Well, when I was a kid, I always liked Bing Crosby. And, of course, if you know Bing Crosby from his movies, you don't know the real Bing Crosby who revolutionized American popular singing.
Please elaborate on that.
Well, Bing Crosby took popular singing styles from the operetta style with the rolled R's, even... I call him a swinging singer, like Al Jolson, still rolled his R's in operetta fashion. And Bing Crosby took the microphone and fashioned a new kind of upbeat jazz singing. And if you listen to, and now I'm talking about the 20s, by the 30s he was already moving away into the commercial ballad stuff, although right to the end of his life he could still swing a song if he wanted to. So I was a great Crosby fan. Crosby revolutionized popular singing. Sinatra, I didn't like until much later. I was a kid when Sinatra was at the Paramount. I remember the girls in my class talking about this 26-year-old guy and how they loved him. And to me, he was just another kind of big band crooner. Maybe they saw something before I did. But in subsequent years, I've come to appreciate him for the absolutely masterful singer that he is.
Who are some of your other favorite singers?
Well, when I was a kid, I particularly liked Dick Hames. Now, later, I became somewhat ashamed of that because he was a very kind of saccharine singer, but a very good stylist. And I was very interested to read that Nat King Cole's brother, whose name I believe is Freddie Cole, who performs around New York now, about a year ago, was asked who his singing, he plays and sings, who his singing influences were. And one of them, he said, was, I used to listen to Dick Haymes. And Dick Haymes was great at phrasing a ballad. And so now my own taste is kind of redeemed.
How about Mel Torme?
I remember when he came up. I'm sure he's a very fine musician. He was a composer when he was still in high school, but I never liked his singing. I still don't. There are others. Joe Stafford. I don't know how many people remember. Joe Stafford is very highly regarded by musicians. I never liked her. Peggy Lee is very highly regarded by musicians. I remember seeing Cy Coleman, who's an old friend, and I asked him why he had helped the arrangements of Peggy Lee's show on Broadway, which I thought was a terrible vanity production. And he said, well, I know that show wasn't particularly good or it didn't work out well, but every musician in the world has such high regard for Peggy Lee as a singer that it sounded very much like the same thing. And it's something that I, with no access to Mossad secrets, just concocted as a logical exercise in what a nation with nuclear weapons threatened with extinction might do to save itself.
Was it based on news stories at the time? For example, the smuggling of enriched plutonium out of Pennsylvania by the CIA to Israel, or was it just totally fantastical in
based,
your mind?
Based on no news stories whatever. I cannot recall having read any of those stories at the time. And it was a new idea then, Israel having nuclear weapons. This, after all, was 1975. What might happen? It was a construct entirely in my own mind.
Do you find writing novels to be easier than writing for television because there are less restrictions, or is it difficult for you to write novels?
Oh, it's a much more ambitious undertaking. One of the advantages to writing for television, aside from the more immediate payment than you get for writing a novel, is that you are given your limits. You're given the framework on which you're to write. You're supplied with the subject matter. To write a novel is to invent a world, and it really is quite an ambitious undertaking. It's to invent a world and then to try to populate it and flesh it out. And it's really a long-term job. It's very exciting because in the world in which you and I live, we are players, but we can't control the other players. When you write a novel, you're creating your world, you create the players, and everybody, you're the king of your world. And everybody is doing something that you are having him or her do. Although it is surprising how your characters do tend to take over. And you realize that as you move in a certain direction in a novel, your characters don't want to go that way. You've created them, but the logic of their own lives and feelings takes you another way. And you have to go that way.
So it's like a chess game where a certain progression of moves dictates what the moves will be in terms of the character's personality.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it is a chess game that, in a sense, in which you're playing both sides. So nothing is out of your control. And yet you find there are things out of your control. If you have time, there's one very interesting story that Neil Simon told me when I was interviewing him at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. I said, did you ever take a course in playwriting? He said, no. He said, but I read a book on playwriting, and the book said you're supposed to outline the whole play before you start writing it. He said, so I did. He said, I'd outline the play and I'd start writing. He said, and the characters would want to go this way. He said, and I would take them and I would shove them back into the outline. He said, but they wanted to go that way. So he said, pretty soon I stopped outlining the whole play and I started outlining an act at a time, he said. And after that, I stopped outlining entirely. So he really had found what I'm sure most every writer finds, that your characters do take on a life of their own and they want to go their way.
In writing your novels, Leonard Harris, do you work with your editor from the beginning, once the manuscript is finished, and do you have a kind of Fitzgeraldian relationship with your editor?
No. Well, the first three, I had the same editor on the first three. But I write them by myself, and I have nothing like Fitzgerald's relationship with Perkins, nothing at all. But I have no Perkins, but then I'm no Fitzgerald, so it evens out. They are really my own creatures. The one that I'm writing now, no editor has even seen. I don't have a contract for it or anything. I haven't even showed it to any editor yet. I'm just living in my world and writing it, and sooner or later I'm going to have to show it to an editor, I suppose.
Who among your contemporary writers, colleagues, do you like now?
Among my contemporaries? Well, there are two guys who are just about my age whom I admire, whom I don't know, but I admire a lot, and there's nothing startling here. One is John Updike. I think his three rabbit books will come to be regarded as American masterpieces, masterpieces of American life. And the other is Philip Roth. I think Philip Roth is a very fine writer and a very smart writer.
Do you think Rabbit Angstrom has elements of Updike's own personality in him, or is he a completely independent character?
Well, again, can I counter with a story that a famous writer told me?
Certainly.
I was once interviewing Tennessee Williams, and I asked him the daring question. I read somewhere that Blanche DuBois is you. And he didn't get offended at all. He said, all my characters are me. That is, in the sense that you draw from yourself for every character you write. You are thinking for that person, and so that person has got to take on some of your thinking. After all, it is your thinking. Do I think that Rabbit is Updike? From everything I know about Updike, he's not at all like Updike. But I'm sure Updike has given him a lot of Updike's concerns. Comes from the same kind of hometown as Updike does. Concerned about death, concerned about the humdrumness of going through your everyday life and getting along with people, and this sort of grind, this untheatrical, unliterary, very ordinary daily grind of trying to get along with your wife and get along with your kids and make your way in the world. I'm sure Updike shares that with him, although Updike is not at all the same kind of person as Rabbit.
You're listening to WBI New York, 99.5 FM. This is Art Breaking. I'm Charlie Finch. Glad to have you with us. My guest is Leonard Harris, longtime cultural critic for WCBS, novelist, and writer for television. Leonard, what do you think of the John Cheever controversy, the publication of his letters, of his journals, the debate about whether his family has exploited his memory? Have they exploited his memory?
Well, I think the question is, and I'm not sure, one question is what he wanted. I haven't read the complete ones, but I certainly have read the things in the New Yorker. And as I said to a friend of mine, one of the things I liked about them is they make my life so much happier by comparison. It's just astounding that somebody who was on the surface successful, an acclaimed writer with no money problems after a certain point, should lead such a desperate life. It reminds me of the Joe Heller book, Something Happened, which I think is a brilliant book, because in it we see a man in advertising, I think he was, leading a desperate life, and only at the end of the book do we learn that externally, to those of us who might be watching, he was a very successful guy. He was promoted in his ad agency, but his life is desperate. And Cheever's life, I know this is a little bit away from, but we'll get back to it. Cheever's life was equally desperate for an acclaimed writer. Do I think it's exploiting him? Did he want those? Did he have any caveat against those things being published? I don't think so. I think it's also a very real issue of, does any writer write those extensive memoirs with an idea that nobody will ever see them? I don't believe so. I think that every writer probably wants that stuff to be published.
Of course, the journals were distilled from thousands and thousands of pages. I guess, mm-hmm. Did Bob Gottlieb do that?
Yep, that's what I read.
And yet
yeah.
The writing is so polished. I don't know if you're a particular fan of Cheever's as I am.
I am, yeah.
Is it the lot of a writer to be a little manic depressive, a little depressed, because he or she has to confront reality constantly and remolded in words?
In one of Tennessee Williams' short stories, which was the kind of a model for Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, there is a teenage boy character. And the teenage boy at one point says to himself, watching life in this small town, and then I realized that life as it existed was not good enough for me, and I would have to reorder it. That's what a writer does. He reorders life that doesn't look good enough to him as it is. If life looks sufficiently good to you as it is, and you want to jump into the arena, you become an industrialist or a politician. If you would rather stand aside, being slightly miserable, and find fault with life and judge it, you tend to become a writer. So the answer to your question is kind of is yes. If you're too well adjusted to life, you become an actor in it.
I can remember a story about Cheever that at one point when he was living in New York and was broke with his family, that he would get up every morning and dress in a suit and tie and take a briefcase as if he was going to the office, and his family was unaware that he wasn't going to the office. And then he would go down to the janitor's room and slip the janitor a dollar and take off his pants and his underwear and tie and shirt, write all day, and then come back as if he had been in an office job. What about the Norman Mailer book, Harlot's Ghost? Have you read it?
No.
Are you going to attempt to read it?
Well, I went into a bookstore. I found I couldn't lift it. So I suppose I could have it delivered. No, I don't know that I want to. It's just, first of all, I'm very much immersed in the subject matter of this book. So what I'm reading now, I'm trying to, this book, War Songs, I'm trying to focus on that. I probably would be interested in reading it, although I've never been a fan, particularly of Norman Mailer's.
Mailer suggested that as one goes along, one should rip the pages one has already read out of the book to make it lighter and lighter as you go through it. Leonard Harris, in War Songs, the book you're working on now, how are you going to convey the world of jazz music and jazz?
Well, so far, I'm doing it badly so far. I don't know. I really don't know. I haven't solved that. I'm groping. I'm trying to show the life of a band on the road. Now, it's a famous story how tough it is on the road and why so many musicians quit, although they were making good money, because life was so miserable. I'm trying to show that. I don't know how I'm going to do any of it. I certainly don't know how I'm going to convey the feeling of the music, except maybe to have a CD accompany the book. I don't know. The answer is I don't know.
Are you thinking of a particular big band to model this band on?
Well, the band that the guy was in is a second string band. It's not a Benny Goodman band. It's not a Dorsey band. It's a band, although there were so many of them. There were bands that they used to call Mickey Mouse bands. I suppose Kay Kaiser was one of those. Sammy, they did all sorts of stunts and humor, and Sammy
Ishka Kay. Bibble.
Ishka Bibble, that was Kay Kaiser.
Yes. Yeah.
Do you know, I can't think of his name, but his daughter, Amanda Kaiser, is married to a very good writer. He used to work for Channel 13. When I think of his name, I'll get back to you on that. So the band that my hero joins is almost a Mickey Mouse band, but it does play some good music. So I don't have in mind any of the really top-line major bands like Miller or Dorsey or Goodman or Artie Shaw or any of those people.
Now, in your days as a theater critic, who was the most difficult person that you ever had to interview?
Oh, well, I remember... mind, this is not as a theater critic, but Rock Hudson being very difficult, only in the sense that, of course, I didn't know much about people's private lives then, and I still don't specialize in learning about their private lives. But I remember from the minute I walked into his hotel room to interview him, he was so on guard, so closed. I mean, he was perfectly polite, and he was doing his job, which was to push whatever movie he was there pushing, and I was doing mine, which was to get an interview with him that I could write for the World Telegram. But I remember how guarded he was. There was no moment of openness at all. I also remember interviewing Nureyev. Again, newspaper interview. See, when you're there with a camera, It's a whole different story. People are then performing. When you're not, you get to see much more of them because they know that only what you're writing down is going to emerge and you're not taking pictures of them. Nureyev, how mercurial he was. And I got the first newspaper interview with him in New York when he arrived with the Royal Ballet. One moment he was charming and extremely intelligent, by the way, extremely. The next moment he had turned off and he was somewhere else and I couldn't get through to him at all. It was incredible.
Did he come back or just stay in that
and
mode?
And then toward the end he came back, but mostly out of a sense of concluding the thing. I never fully got him back. Ethel Merman was reputed to be a difficult person, and she was difficult. And then I remember very well, because now it seems comparatively young to me, I had read two sources for her age, 55 and 57, but the 57 sounded more accurate, and I used that in the story, and our press agent said she was absolutely livid, furious at my having said she was 57 when she claimed she was only 55. But she was a very difficult interview. She did say one funny thing. I said, "Are you ever nervous when you're on stage?" And she said, "Not at all. I look out there into the audience and I say, if they could do what I'm doing as well as I could, they'd be up here and not me. So I'm never nervous."
That's the merm for you. Leonard Harris, do you think America will ever lose its infatuation with actors and actresses as celebrities? And does it seem to you now that there's more of that than ever? Or were the 50s comparable in terms of that kind of adoration?
One would hope we'd lose some of our adoration for them, but I don't see it. No, I see it increasing. And the reason I see it increasing is the means of distribution. I mean, television became the major fact of fandom. Certainly the fan magazines of the 20s and 30s and 40s enabled starstruck people to adore their stars. But nowhere could you get the impact of TV, and especially MTV, for musical people. I mean, it's given a whole new impact to stardom. And I can't see that reversing itself.
But there seems to be some confusion in the public mind as to the roles versus the real person, and an assumption that actors and actresses know so much more about politics and other things than they perhaps really do. Do you find that's true?
Well, the actors used to be kept sequestered from politics. Under the old studio system, actors were kept absolutely clear of that. As you know, the guys who ran Hollywood had a very all-American image of Hollywood. It's what they were trying to promulgate. All-American people who were not political and who stood for unquestioned American values, apple pie. And they didn't want to see stars involved in political causes. Now we see stars heavily involved in political causes, and stars have the same right as anybody else. The question is what impact they have on elections. I don't think they have very much. I mean, the Hollywood community as a group is very liberal. They're certainly always with a Democratic presidential candidate, and he always seems to lose. So I don't think they're having any effect beyond what they should, namely that they're stars, but they don't know any more or less about politics than other people do.
I can't let you leave here, Leonard Harris, without discussing New York politics a bit with you. Do you think Mario Cuomo should run, and do you think he will run?
Well, we were talking about the article, the op-ed piece in the Times by Roger Stone, who is a Republican consultant, who said that they would love to see Cuomo run because, and his words are, he is from a tax and crime state, a high tax and high crime state, and he would carry those negatives with him into an election. He's also a liberal, for which I admire him. He's also an ethnic Northeastern person, and very much, I mean, analogous to Dukakis. The difference is, I would hope and assume that he would be a much more effective and mesmerizing candidate than Dukakis was. This is my own personal feeling. I would like to see the Democrats nominate somebody who can be elected, because it now appears that Bush is highly beatable.
You know, I've seen the governor speak in California and in Washington, D.C., and he has less baggage there because of his
Socratic style. Audiences just drink milk out of his hand. The head of the Mississippi Democratic Party was quoted as saying, "We don't have too many Marios in Mississippi." And I'll bet you he could go to Jackson and round up thousands of votes in one appearance. Do you find that politicians now in New York are less competent than they were back in the 60s, say in the Lindsay administration?
Well, you know, Lindsay did a lot of things wrong. Lindsay had a lot of critics. I mean, and Lindsay was lambasted. I don't know if politicians are less capable in New York, but New York's become a tougher place to run, especially in the past 10 years. And the reason it's become a tougher place to run is largely, I don't want to sound like Mario Cuomo now, or like Dinkins, but largely the fault of the cutoff of federal aid to social programs. So I think it's a bigger problem than just New York.
Well, Leonard Harris, I'd like to thank you for being my guest on Art Breaking today. We look forward to your book, War Songs, when it comes out. Hope you'll join us again in the near future. It was a great pleasure. You're listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM. See you next week at the usual time, 3 to 4 p.m. Good afternoon.